Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, science, debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your emails, and your live calls. Wow, such a lot to do in just an hour, but before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. Well, some very exciting stuff in the news this week that I want to share with you. We've got a flu update coming later on. Of course, we've got the latest healthcare bill blow by blow, although I'll try to keep it short because there is lots of blows to come in all senses of the word. But let's start with chronic fatigue syndrome. I thought this was an extremely important piece of research. This is about the story of ancient viruses. We've known for a long time, maybe as much as 20 years, that much of human DNA seems to be contaminated with viruses that are just sort of sitting there, not necessarily replicating or doing anything. And there's been a lot of debate and discussion about how this may have contributed to the actual evolution of mammals and the human species ultimately. Of course, that's, we're a little self-centered, so we think about human evolution. So this is important stuff. And a newly discovered virus, it's a retrovirus like HIV, it's called XMRV, and it's related to a mouse leukemia virus, but it's not exactly the same, but it shares some homology. This has only been known about for about 3 years, and it was found by a Dr. Silverman at the Cleveland Clinic who was researching prostate cancer. And what he did was he took chopped up prostate cancer and put it on a biological array looking for viral DNA, and there was this one virus that kept showing up. So that was sequenced, and because of its similarity to the murine leukemia virus, it got that name. But it was found in a very high percentage of prostate cancers, and particularly aggressive prostate cancers. We reported on this some time ago, and I'll just wanting to remind you of it. It was found in prostate cancers that were the most aggressive, and it was only found in a small number of healthy cells, 3.7% of healthy controls, and a much greater percentage, sorry, I don't have it right here, of prostate cancers. So recently, however, this plot thickens. A researcher in chronic fatigue syndrome gave Dr. Silverman blood samples of 100 chronic fatigue syndrome patients and 200 and change healthy controls. And Dr. Silverman detected this XMRV virus in 67% of the chronic fatigue syndrome patients. Now, this is interesting, but it could just be that chronic fatigue syndrome patients who have oddities of their immune system seem to be revved up and they're releasing lots of inflammatory cytokines, but they have a lower than normal titer of natural killer cells. So you could just postulate maybe they're more likely to get infected. Could be true. However, what they showed was that if you take the infected human mononuclear cells and you put them with cultured prostate cancer cells, you can transfer this virus to the prostate cells. And it's also been shown that if you look for antibodies to this XMRV virus, you'll find that it's present in about 95% of chronic fatigue syndrome patients and only 4% of healthy controls. So at this point, it's a lead. We don't know if it's cause or effect. And I think it's extremely important to emphasize that this does not establish that this virus causes chronic fatigue. We went down that road before with Epstein-Barr virus, and it turned out that, in fact, people with chronic fatigue syndrome make higher levels of antibodies to a lot of common viruses. It's, like I said, their immune system is revved up. But maybe, just maybe, this is going to be a foot in the door to solving the trigger of chronic fatigue syndrome. It's going to be more complicated than that. There's going to be more about it than this, but really important stuff. And I thought I should be the first to tell you. I also want to say bravo to the three Americans who just got the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Dr. Blackborn and Dr. Greeter are both female, and Dr. Stostak SZO. Stosak is working at Harvard, and he's an American now. He was born in London, however. Well, the good news is that their research was about telomerase, and telomerase is one of the more important discoveries in DNA in the last 20 years. It's the little enzyme that builds extra caps on the ends of your chromosome that keep your chromosomes healthy. Every time your cells divide, your telomeres get a little bit shorter. Now, if you happen to be a cancer cell, you have high levels of this enzyme telomerase, which rebuild the caps on the endpoints of your chromosomes. And recently, in a 2006 study, Dr. Blackburn demonstrated that people who are under high stress, such as women caring for special needs children, chronically ill special needs children, I need to specify, have telomeres that are 18 years shorter than their age-matched counterpoint. So stress shortens your life. We've all seen that. Have you done a gray hair count on Obama's scalp lately? I think it's gone up. Anyway, another good thing about telomeres is that they represent a target for both cancer therapy and also for potential life prolongation. And last and not least, Blackburn did a study with Dean Ornish recently that shows if you go on a Mediterranean diet and exercise, your telomeres get longer. So you can actually reverse aging at any age by changing your behavior. And in a follow-up study, this is looking at 85-year-olds. Sedentary 85-year-olds, or I should say previously sedentary 85-year-olds who started to exercise, doubled their 3-year survival rate compared to 85-year-olds who did not do an intervention. The exercise in question, walking 4 hours weekly, even if it's just a 15-minute stroll a couple of times a day. This is research done in Israel, was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine recently. So it doesn't take a lot of exercise to build those telomeres up. Plus, there's other research that shows that there is something called brain-derived growth factor, and when you exercise, that goes up as well. So not only does exercise make you live longer, it may actually make you smarter. As cells divide, your telomeres get shorter. Shorter telomeres eventually start eroding into the chromosomes. The telomerase is the enzyme that makes your telomeres longer, and so high levels of telomerase are associated with immortality in cancer cells, and while we don't want to give ourselves cancer, maybe we can tweak our telomerase in healthier ways. Another thing that we know about telomerase is that resveratrol, which is present in red wine, will actually improve telomerase levels. It'll increase the length of those telomeres. So all sorts of intertwining factors here. We're learning something every minute. Here's an email that I got this week from Amber in San Diego. Dear Dr. Don, I recently found a public grapefruit grove and have been enjoying eating lots of grapefruits. I remember hearing on your show about a study where grapefruit juice caused medicines to stay longer in the body. The only medicine that I'm on is Trinessa, birth control. Will the grapefruit juice mess with my hormones? I probably drink between 6 to 8 ounces of grapefruit juice a day. Thanks so much. Well, thank you very much for the question, Amber, and I will point you out to a show that we rebroadcast a few weeks ago, the Jeffrey Bland Show on Detoxification, where we talk about how the body breaks down drugs. In the case of grapefruit, it inhibits an enzyme in your liver called CYP3A4. This is an important enzyme because it's implicated in the breakdown of many drugs. So, for example, if you were taking a statin drug, you would have higher levels of that statin if you also took grapefruit. In fact, this has been exploited by transplant doctors because one of the very expensive transplant rejection drugs that are given is cyclosporin. And if you are also taking grapefruit juice, you can cut the dose of cyclosporin by more than 50%. And still have adequate protection. So you can use this to your advantage or to your disadvantage. Now, unfortunately, in the case of your question, you probably are having a change in your breakdown of your birth control pill by drinking the grapefruit juice. Steroid hormones are going through, in many people, this CYP3A4 pathway. So there are alternative pathways, and what will happen in your case is that your body will shunt your birth control synthetic hormones to those alternative pathways. And unless you have a mutation such that those pathways are weak, you should be able to tolerate your birth control pills. But you can essentially look at it in terms of side effects. If you're seeing more breast tenderness or your periods have gotten significantly changed since starting your grapefruit habit, then you may need to go to an even lower dose birth control pill or back off on the grapefruit. So I hope that was helpful to you. Another email from Randy in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Dear Dr. Don, I download your podcast to my iPhone so I can listen while I garden, drive, and walk. I recommend this practice to all of you, by the way. I so appreciate your knowledge, wisdom, and advice. I was having a heated discussion with some friends about the validity of muscle testing used to diagnose endocrine system dysfunction. It just doesn't make any sense to me, but I told my friends I would do an internet search and get back to them. I looked for a search function on your website, couldn't find it, so I'm using the direct approach. Please give me your opinion of muscle testing as used in applied kinesiology or direct me to one of your shows where you've addressed this. Thank you so much for your time. Well, thank you, Randy, for your direct approach. And let me just describe applied kinesiology as I am going to comment upon it, because there are several manifestations of that phrase. But the one I'm going to talk about is where a person is asked to hold a substance in one hand or place it in their mouth, and then someone has them hold their arm out and applies downward pressure on their arm. And if this is a substance that their body is reacting negatively towards, the hypothesis goes, then the arm will become weak when it's placed in the mouth and the person's arm will drop with less pressure. Whereas if they don't have that in their mouth, they'll be able to hold their arm up against downward pressure. Now, the problem with this is mechanisms, okay? First of all, when you've got a manifestation, you can say, what would be the mechanisms of this? Assumes this phenomenon is true and a person's arm does get weak when they put something in their mouth. What could happen? Well, it could be hypnosis or suggestion, a placebo effect, in other words, and that's certainly plausible. It could be that the person pushing down is also being subject to the placebo effect and is not pushing as hard, even though they think they are. Let's assume that everyone is being completely honest and not cheating. Just for the sake of argument, let's assume that people are telling the truth, because obviously if they're lying, well, you know, it's a done deal. But let's assume that the examiner believes that they are pushing down as hard. Are they really? Or are they themselves manifesting a change in what they do that leads to a different result? So you've got two possibilities there, both of which could be occurring through the subconscious without anybody telling any lies. I have trouble with figuring out how it could actually be true. I'm a great believer in acupuncture and field phenomenon, so I could maybe come up with some sort of idea that there's a more or less instantaneous electrophysiology effect going on, but that's never been measured or mapped, and so it's really just a hypothesis. But I'm dubious. And I'm also dubious because this has been around for a very, very long time, and it's pretty easy to validate, okay? We have devices that will apply downward pressure in a measured way. A spring-loaded device, just hanging a weight from someone's arm. Easy peasy to do the research to show that this is actually true, and cheap. Also, very cheap. And yet, people who are making, you know, a good living doing applied kinesiology have never really bothered to validate their work. And so at this point, I'm saying, interesting idea. I'm waiting for the data. Until I see data, I would say, if someone came to me and said, well, my applied kinesiology test says I'm allergic to wheat, I'd say, fine, let's get a blood test. Because I'd want to be validating that. I'd consider it an intuition at this point, not a valid diagnosis. And I'd want a valid diagnosis before I treated a patient. Let's take a call. Before I do that, I want to say that if anyone needs help finding a specific topic from old shows, you can email my producer. Just go to Ask Dr. Don and put in your question, what you're looking for, and my producer will help you find the appropriate thing. Let's go to Karen in Santa Cruz. Hello, Karen. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I called you maybe last year talking about nail ridges, and you were mentioning poor blood flow.
Yes.
The nail ridges have just continue to get worse, and I have been concerned about it because my arms slowly but surely they're kind of numb, and if I lay my arm on a table for a while, I get all that pins and needles, and they just kind of feel numb anyway. So I went to my doctor, and I talked to her about it, and the different things were going on, and she said, from what you're saying, it's more likely you've got nerve problems in your neck, which may work out because my neck goes zigzag. Mm. I've got a real bad injury on my leg, and it may have pulled on the vertebrae. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if that could be affecting the nail ridges.
The ridges are horizontal across the fingers, or are they vertical in the line of growth?
Vertical in the line of growth.
Okay.
I mean, straight up and down.
Straight up and down, yeah, along the long axis of the fingers.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So the answer to your base question, which is could a pinched nerve be related to this, is yes, but not directly.
Okay.
Okay, so depending upon how your arm tingling is manifesting itself, it's either blood flow or a pinched nerve. And one way to tell is if it's a pinched nerve, a single pinched nerve, it'll tend not to cover the entire hand front and back. So it won't be like a glove.
Okay.
Okay, the only thing that does glove is either blood flow or peripheral neuropathy, which is a different kind of nerve problem, more of a nutritional metabolic nerve problem, not related to a pinched nerve. So you can sort of ask yourself the question, when it is numb or tingly, where is it tingly? Could I take a marker and draw the areas that feel tingly and the areas that feel normal?
Like on the inside and on the palm side of my hand.
Okay, so if it's on the palm and the pinky, is that what you mean by the inside?
No, it's more like if I lay my hand on the table, it's the underside of my arm and the underside of my hand.
Yes, so you have to decide whether when it's going on. So it's just the palm, so you have to decide pinky or thumb or both.
Oh, I see. You're saying that they affect the nerves.
Different nerves go to the pinky and to the thumb. So it's a clue. A lot of people get tension in the elbow joint, and it pinches the nerve that goes to the pinky.
Okay.
And they won't feel it on the palm, on the thumb. And
a thumb. I'd have to say thumb.
Okay. So then you're thinking median nerve, and median nerve would be the carpal tunnel, which is in the center of the wrist. And it's where the nerve comes in through a tight space. Keyboarders, people who are spending a lot of time with their arms twisted and their palms straight down, that's not a normal resting position, will sometimes get carpal tunnel syndrome. There's also pinching at the underarm. That's called thoracic outlet. And in thoracic outlet, you can pinch both the nerve and the blood flow. So that might be a way to explain the fingernails. The other thing to keep in mind is that if you pinch the sympathetic portion of the nerve, that there's a sympathetic wiring cable, if you will, from the autonomic nervous system that runs in these nerves, and that is what controls the size of the blood vessels. So certain kinds of pinched nerve phenomenon will actually affect the blood flow to the limb as well. So it's extremely complicated and difficult to sort out, and probably you need a neurologist to evaluate you more fully for this.
You've given me a really good clue because my shoulder joints have always given me a problem. And I'm thinking, yes, and I probably will go to a neurologist and see. But she was telling me certain things about it and some what you have to go through. And I'm going, you know, maybe I better just learn to live with this.
Well, you can refuse nerve conduction studies and still get a lot of information from a neurology exam from a specialist. So if you don't want to have needles stuck in you, I'd still go see the neurologist.
Okay.
Before we had all these tests, we had 100 years of really careful observation and the elaboration of very good neurologic testing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that didn't involve things that you bill Medicare for. It was an office visit kind of testing. And then what happened is we got the MRIs and the CT scanners and the nerve conduction devices, all of which are reimbursed by Medicare, who controls everything, by the way, in terms of how medicine evolves. At that point, people stopped using their brains and they started ordering tests. And that's part of what we need to turn around. You know, I'm putting in my little pitch for healthcare reform here. That's part of what we need to turn around.
I agree. A lot of times more tests is not the answer. And the final thing would be for me is this a dangerous condition for my nails and my hands?
For your nails, well, you know, you could live without your fingernails. It's a cosmetic issue. For your hands, people who have persistent compression on a nerve that isn't addressed can end up with permanent nerve damage.
Whoops.
So, yeah, you don't want to mess around with this.
No.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time. That sure does help calm me down because now I know what I can look for,
Exactly. And also you know that you don't have to do everything that the specialist tells you to do.
Exactly.
You could say, what's your best guess without sticking needles in me, doctor?
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. We need to give people a permission to be a little bit more proactive. This just out from the FDA. One of my associates up at Scotts Valley Medical Clinic has been doing this now off-label for a while, and I've been kind of saying we should wait till the data's out before we start expanding vaccination indications, but I got to hand it to Dr. Maris. He was right on this one. FDA advisors support using HPV vaccine for males. So this would be the Gardasil vaccine, which has been out for a while for girls age 9 through 26 for the prevention of cervical, vulvar, and vaginal cancer caused by those nasty oncogenic HPV viruses type 16 and 18. And it's also good against genital warts, 6 and 11. So the FDA has now approved this for boys and men for prevention of genital warts and also secondarily prevention of genital cancers, although genital cancers are very rare in men. I think the key point about this, and we don't have data yet, but I think if we vaccinate the boys, then effectively we're protecting the unvaccinated girls because men are the vectors for cervical cancer. The more partners a girl has had in her lifetime, and this is in the bad old days before the vaccine, but the more partners a woman has had, the higher her probability of getting cervical cancer. And we know that men are the vectors. So, like we're doing with H1N1, it sort of makes sense to vaccinate the vectors. And now we have data in 4,000 males that we do reduce the frequency of the things we can measure, which would be the 16 and 11 genital warts. And by extrapolation, it's going to take an awful lot of years and data to prove this, but I think it's a reasonable extrapolation and certainly one I support. We're giving a benefit to the males as it is, and we are also potentially benefiting an entire generation of women by doing this. Here's another email, this one from Allison in Brooklyn. Dear Dr. Don, I'm 26, living in Brooklyn, and enjoy listening to your show, particularly the discussions about blending Eastern and Western medicine. I am a sound location mixer for film, and I've had tinnitus for about 4 years. You say tinnitus, I say tinnitus. It sort of started after I had a bad case of the flu, and interestingly enough, started before I decided to take up sound as a career. Around the time it started, I got a hearing test and did not have any hearing damage. I don't turn up my headphones loud, although I do listen for up to 10 hours a day, and I try to limit my exposure to loud sounds and music, though that is difficult when living in New York City. I usually just have a very low-level, high-pitched ringing that I only hear when it's quiet at night, but occasionally I get a ring in one ear at a time that goes off loudly and blocks out all the other sounds for a few seconds. Is there anything I can do to fix this and make sure it doesn't get worse? Thank you. Allison, I am going to just riff a little bit here on the subject of this. I want to mention that the Eustachian tube can be going in and out of adjustment. So the thing to say about the Eustachian tube is that if the pressures are not equal on either side of the eardrum, then what will happen is that the eardrum won't vibrate properly, and then you won't be getting a normal level of sound to the sensing apparatus in the inner ear. When that happens, there's circuitry in the brain, in the nervous system, that will actually increase the gain level. So you're an audio technician. You understand that when you increase the sensitivity, you also increase the noise ratio. And so that signal-to-noise ratio is what's giving you your tinnitus. Since it happens for only a few seconds, there's two possible culprits. One is that your Eustachian tube is blocking off, and the other is that you are having problems from tightening your jaw joint. Now, a lot of people living in New York City tighten their jaw joints on a regular basis, or they clench their teeth. It may be that when you clench, you actually manage to shut your Eustachian tube off such that the pressures, well, basically the nitrogen in the atmosphere absorbs into your bloodstream and you get a vacuum in your middle ear. That'll damp down the signal. And then this gain phenomenon that I'm talking about in the sensory apparatus of the inner ear will actually increase and you'll end up with the tinnitus for a couple of seconds until something causes you to yawn or swallow and you open up the Eustachian tube and the pressures equalize. So that can be attributable to allergies, inflammation, chronic congestion, and it can also come from problems in the jaw. So hopefully that's given you enough information and you'll be able to make progress on your own by following up those leads. I certainly hope so. Let's do a little flu update. The swine flu has spread across the entire United States, and we are particularly worried about pregnant women. There's something about the swine flu that makes it especially nasty for pregnant women, and we don't quite know what that is, but we're seeing it. We had, as of late August, 100 pregnant women in the United States have been hospitalized in intensive care, and 28 have died. And that's why we're encouraging pregnant women to go and get the H1N1 vaccine when it becomes available. Death of almost 30% of those who become significantly ill is really a phenomenal number. It's something to pay very, very close attention to. This is a big deal. People who have asthma, obesity, diabetes, or heart problems have also shown extraordinarily high death rates relative to what we normally see with cases of flu. And this is a flu that is proving in the general population to be quite mild. So all the more reason for us to target that population. And I wanted to put that out because of a call we had last week. The state of California also put out their school draft manual for H1N1, and that is available on the Department of Education's website, California Department of Education. I'll put that link on the Ask Dr. Don website if you are interested in looking at that. And let's go to a caller. We have Jane in Denver. Hello, Jane. Welcome to the program. Hello. Hello.
Hi. I had a colonoscopy, Dr. Don, and they told me I have diverticulosis, and I have a little tenderness there all the time. That's why I went and had it done, and nothing else was the problem. Is there any hope to cure this? Or
Sure. Remember, you rebuild your colon. You rebuild the inside of your colon every 5 days. That's an amazingly rapid rate of turnover. Your surface skin is about 30 days. So the whole colon itself takes about a year to be reconstructed, but you rebuild everything because all cells essentially are replaced. I mean, it's at a very slow level, but effectively you can restructure your body structures. And if you eat a consistently high fiber diet and achieve good bowel movements, and what does that mean? That means that you don't have to push. Because you can think of the diverticulosis, which are little outpouchings, little herniations or pooches that are forming in your colon because you're pushing too hard. The pressure inside is too great, so the colon kind of balloons out between the muscle fibers. You've got to stop that. Some people are more prone to this because their collagen that they inherited from their parents is weaker in the colon, and so they actually have a genetic propensity. And for them, they have to be very, very careful about straining, and even then they may still have problems. But in general, it's the result of too much processed food, basically. Too much milled flour as opposed to whole grains that people, you know, crushed up in a mortar and pestle and were full of little sticks and stones and bits of fiber. So increasing your fiber and using stool softeners if necessary, such that you just sit down and relax and out it comes.
Well, you got me onto probiotics because I was extremely constipated, went to India. So I've been on probiotics, and that's fantastic. I've got toothpaste consistency. It's wonderful.
Good.
So that's been that way for several months, but I still have the tenderness on the left side, especially at night when I lay down.
Yeah, it's going to take a while. It's going to take a year or more for your colon, for the actual structural changes to revise themselves.
Should I not eat seeds?
No, that has been...
I mean, tiny seed things?
No, that has been disproven. The only time I've ever had a case where I really thought it was attributable was popcorn. Because the kernel, the undigested, the unpopped corn kernel, is just exactly the right size. So they say watermelon seeds and so, but really the thing that works like a plug perfectly in a diverticula is popcorn. Little seeds, sesame seeds, poppy seeds, that's like been disproven multiple times, but you still find it in doctors' heads because that's what we were taught. And it's really hard to get information out of your head once it's in there, unless you make a real effort at it. And people are, you know, kind of lazy and often don't unlearn things in the light of new information.
But aloe vera is being sold on the internet to help heal diverticulosis. Is that just drinking some aloe vera juice?
I don't understand how it could help, except
how could that help?
Yeah, maybe it contains some soluble fiber, so it might be working at that level. Soluble fiber gets digested by your good bacteria, and then that's turned into butyric acid, which is what feeds the colon. So you could make a sort of argument that aloe vera, if it would help feed the colon and help with regeneration, but that's really just the colonocyte, the intestinal wall. And what you have here is you have to really get a structural change back. So I think it's good behavior for a long time.
Okay.
Keep up the
I'll
good
do
work.
It then.
Keep up the good work.
Okay. Bye.
And I want to point out to those people, you may have noticed that when I was doing emails, a lot of those emails were for people who are out there listening to the podcast. And yeah, I know everything on the web is free. Not everything on the web you can get for free, but ultimately it costs something to produce it. And electricity, equipment, all of that stuff. If you're having a life benefit from listening to Ask Dr. Don, I'd appreciate if you'd go online to KUSP.org and make a small donation, whatever you think this show is worth to you. And we can handle pledges of 88 cents or $1.50 or whatever you think is right. So let me put that out there to my podcast listeners. That's www.kusp.org. And now let's go to Robert in Soquel. Hello, Robert.
Good morning, Dr. Don. Not to be a particular show for your exhortations, but you know, the advice that you're giving very eruditely is worth some serious money.
Thank you. I think so.
It's just for that. It's anyway, I've been trying to reduce the cholesterol and avoid the levostatin with red yeast. I think I may not pronounce it correctly. Propoxyphenol?
Polycosenol. Yeah. Polycosenol.
There you go. And
tomato, tomato.
And then some plant sterols.
I'm sorry, what was that last one?
Plant sterol.
Plant stanols. Okay, good.
Is it stanols?
It's stanols, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was sterols.
Yeah, these are plant alcohols that alter the way our body absorbs fat, and so they help keep,
right.
Yeah, so they help okay. keep us from having extra fat to process.
So can you add anything to that list? Or?
Well, first of all, if your triglycerides are above 100, then you need to cut back on starch, and so that's a little known thing that helps lower cholesterol.
Okay.
I always recommend that my patients take a mixture of DHA and EPA. These are two of the omega-3 fatty acids, up to 4,000 milligrams of those together. But you can do less than 4,000 milligrams if your gums bleed when you floss, which I hope you're doing if you have high cholesterol. Because
oh yeah, I'm a floss maniac.
Good. And dental hygiene is really, really important. What about oat bran? Are you doing oat bran? That's another one.
I was doing oat bran.
Yeah, oat bran is really good. Essentially, what you'd like to do is you'd like to bar the door, absorb less, and then alter your physiology so you make less. You don't want no cholesterol. In fact, I want to just put this out there. If your serum cholesterol total is under 150, you are at risk of actually interfering with steroid biosynthesis and messing up your hormones.
Okay.
So particularly for older men, we know that low testosterone is associated with heart disease. So we have to be careful we don't lower the cholesterol so far that we make our men hypotestosteronemic, I guess.
Thank you. Mine is around 175, but that's with the levostatin.
Which is hoping, your total cholesterol?
Yeah, so I'm hoping that I can maintain something like that without the statin drug.
All right, so the idea here is you hit it with all fours. Polycosanol or polycosanol doesn't work for everybody. Oat bran pretty much works for everybody a little bit. If you go to my website, there's something called the Portfolio Diet, which involves mucilaginous vegetables and some other tricks, soy protein, mucilaginous vegetables like eggplant and okra. And this diet was promulgated by the Harvard School of Public Health. This is not exactly a fringe institution. And it works. It works as well as a statin if you follow this diet.
Huh, well, I do like eggplant.
Yeah, so go to my website, follow the links for the Portfolio Diet. It says diet to lower cholesterol. This is a scientifically proven diet that works as well as a statin. That plus some of the nutritional products we've discussed and regular exercise and you don't smoke.
No, of course.
Okay, well, of course not. I love it.
No,
thank you.
No, I say of course not.
Of course not is a good answer.
Pardon me?
When I ask someone if they smoke and they say of course not, I'm really happy with that answer.
Yeah.
I really am.
Fish oil.
Fish oil.
That's good.
Okay.
Stuff. And then I'm an olive oil fanatic, so.
Good. All right. Well, it sounds like you're on the right road.
Thank you very much.
Good luck. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.